Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to stream our television show, get our recipes, or take our free online cooking classes. Enjoy the show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Today I chat with Chef Alon Shaya. We discuss the worst turkey sandwich he ever ate, why he starts his broth in a pot of ice, and how he finally got the chance to make pizza with Enzo in Parma.
He taught in a very militaristic style, you know, like 4 days I was only allowed to cut mushrooms, and then I graduated to cheese, and then eventually I was able to like touch the flour, and then eventually I was able to actually make pizzas there.
Also on today's show, Dan Pashman discusses the food of The Simpsons, and I share my favorite ways to use tahini. But first, it's my interview with food writer and cookbook author Julia Tertian. Julia, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm really good. Small Victories was a fabulous book. And now you've done a book, Now and Again, which is as recipes, but also how to use them for leftovers. And so I thought we'd talk a little bit. I thought there were some great ideas here.
Well, thank you. You
said you can make a pesto with a leftover arugula salad. I just thought that was such an interesting idea.
Yeah, sort of presto, pesto. that idea, I think, speaks to I think really the simplicity of so many ideas in the book, that you can use these things that you might, you know, not see any more life in, you know, wilted old salad. But if you think of it as the components for a pesto, you know, it's already kind of halfway there. You've got some greens and seasoning, and there's even pine nuts in that salad. And so, you know, whizzed all together, you get this great sauce.
And then you had another one, which I think is equally simple, but brilliant, leftover tomato sauce, add some chicken stock, you have soup.
Exactly. Yeah, that was another super simple one. And just truly the idea of stretching one thing and turning it into another. And, you know, the kind of old idea of, you know, if you have some extra people over, just add a little bit more water to the soup pot. So that one takes tomato sauce kind of in that direction.
You have a romaine and celery salad with buttermilk ranch dressing, which looks great. But then you have a sort of concept of a spicy stir-fried lettuce. So you start with a little ginger and garlic and oil, add the sliced celery, and then slices of romaine leaves. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that was an idea. If you've bought maybe a little bit more celery or romaine than you use in the salad, just a way that's very easy to use them both, but also a bit unexpected. You know, I think especially in America, we don't think of lettuce as something that you cook, but it is cooked in different places all over the world. And it's great. It kind of transforms the texture. It makes it this, you know, kind of warm, satisfying dish. And I just am always looking for that road to a recipe that's both really simple and also just a little unexpected.
You do a pho soup with brisket. I kind of like that idea.
So that recipe was one that really, really inspired this whole book. And the story behind that is I grew up in a Jewish family and we celebrate holidays together as a family. And one year I went to my aunt and uncle's house for a Passover Seder. And my aunt had made so much chicken soup and so much brisket that she sent everyone home with leftovers. And my wife, Grace, and I found ourselves eating chicken soup and brisket over and over again. And we were getting like a little bit sick of it, even though those are, you know, two of my favorite things in the world. And so one night I thought it was like the end of the bag of brisket and the end of the container of the soup. And I thought, I can't eat this again. But it was so good and such, you know, great quality food. And I wanted to use it. So I charred an onion. I added it to the stock with some ginger and star anise and cinnamon and the flavors you would often find in pho. And then added the sliced brisket to it with some rice noodles and served it with fresh herbs. And Grace, my wife, was like, oh, you know, when did you order takeout? And I was like, no, this is the same thing.
Thanks
been
a
eating.
Lot, takeout.
Yeah. No, I took it as a compliment. And it really was, you know, these two things we had gotten almost a little bit sick of, and they were totally transformed. And to me, I thought, oh, there's a book in there.
So let's just talk about the philosophy of cooking. People always say, well, you know, I want to improvise. You know, I don't want to just follow recipes. And I often say, well, you should start by following recipes. But take us through the thought process. You know, if I was talking about music, let's say, I'd say, well, here are three concepts. The 1-4-5 chords, you know, that's basic rock and roll. Or here's a pentatonic scale and here's how you can use it. Could you translate that in food? Give me a couple of things, basic ideas that have some meat on them.
Sure, yeah, yeah, so some meat on it.
Yeah, well, or tofu
say,
on it, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's such a great question, and I think I would say the formula I go about is, you know, just off the top of my head, I think it's for any meal I'm making, you know, I think it can be a little hard to always find all the components in one dish, but I think you can really find them in a whole meal. So I try to have something crunchy and something soft, you know, to kind of think of texture. And I would say also salt plus lemon equals always great is another formula. I think that can really transform most things. So if you think of, you know, whatever your ideal meal is, if you break that apart, it'll probably have those components. So for me, you know, like I love a roast chicken with a salad and, you know, some wine on the side. So that's, you know, that's got that sort of crispy chicken skin and, you know, that crunch, but also the soft roasted meat inside the bird, you know, the crunch of the salad, the acid of the vinaigrette. It's got all those components, but it's like a super simple meal. You know, pizza has this sort of soft kind of crust under the tomato sauce, but the crispy crust at the edge, you know, it's got the salt, it's got the fat from the cheese. You know, so I think if you think about the things you already love, I think you can sort of break down the components really easily.
Do you think you can really learn something about a culture through their food?
I absolutely think you can. And it's something I believe in so much. And I think what's most important is, you know, really connecting with whoever made it and understanding what that food means to them. You know, if it's something you've never eaten, maybe you'll learn about a new ingredient or, you know, flavor. And, you know, that can be really exciting. But in terms of really learning about a culture, I think you have to talk to whoever cooked it or read their story or listen to it. And also kind of trace those ingredients and find out where they're from and who grew them. And, you know, I think if we bring that kind of mindset to everything we eat, I mean, we learn so much about each other. And you think about how much you can offer of yourself to someone when you cook them a meal. You know, I was telling you about the the sort of Jewish chicken soup I grew up with. And, you know, to me, that bowl of soup represents my entire history. It represents my family and where they came from and where they fled, you know, and the traditions they brought with them. And yeah, to me, it's my whole family. It's my whole heritage in a bowl. And so when I cook that for someone, I'm not just making you soup. I'm you know, I'm sharing my everything.
Julia, it's been a really pleasure to chat with you. I love your book Now and Again, and all the best going forward.
Well, I really appreciate it. And it was great to talk with you too, Chris.
That was Julia Tershin. Her new book is called Now and Again, Go-To Recipes, Inspired Menus, and Endless Ideas for Reinventing Leftovers. Mill Street Radio is also available as a podcast. You can subscribe and listen whenever you want. New shows go up every Friday on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, Radio Public, and Spotify. Now it's time to open up the phone lines, take some calls with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah, are you ready to be brilliant?
Chris, I am so ready to always be brilliant, yes. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Chrissy from Sturbridge. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, sure. We'd love to help you. How can we help you?
So my question deals with braised meats and stews. I love making braised lamb, and every time I do, they come out, they taste fantastic, but the liquid never has that beautiful deep brown or burgundy color you see in the magazine or in the cookbook. Mine is more of an ugly, unappetizing yellowish brown. I'm using pretty rich red wines, too. I wanted to know, what am I doing wrong?
Are you browning the meat and the chicken?
I am. So I brown the meats first, and then I saute the vegetables, onions, kind of all of that, and the herbs, and then I put the meat back, and I put the red wine in, and I'm doing this all on my Dutch oven, too, and then I put it in the oven.
Well, a few suggestions. A common trick that a lot of people use is tomato paste. So when you saute your onions, you add a tablespoon or two of tomato paste, maybe two. Cook it so it gets
caramelized.
Yeah, really dark for a few minutes.
And
that'll add color and also umami. It has a meaty flavor to it. There is a recipe from Spain, however, and this is how I do stews now, where you don't add the wine at the beginning. You essentially roast the cube meat in a Dutch oven where you've already sauteed some onions, put the meat in, uncovered, and cook it. Covered for, I think, 2 hours and uncovered for an hour. And there's no liquid because there's some liquid will come out of the meat. And you get really brown meat. Okay. You don't have to brown the meat ahead of time because the heat of the oven will do it. The trick here, though, is to take your wine and reduce it down by a good 2/3 over very gentle simmer. It takes about an hour or so. So while you're roasting the meat, do that. Then you get a concentrated wine, which solves the problem. If you cook meat and wine, I find the wine sucks the flavor out of the meat and makes it kind of dry. I don't like it. This way, the meat has more meaty flavor, and you end up with the wine tastes better, the meat tastes better, and you will have, because that browning in the bottom of the Dutch oven will be wonderful.
I think that sounds wonderful. I just want to suggest one other thing. I also reduce the wine, but I do it at the beginning. Brown the meat really well and the onions, and I do the thing with the tomato paste, and then you remove it all from the skillet, and you know, you put everything in the Dutch oven, and then you add the red wine, and I just boil the heck out of it. I don't do it gently. And I do reduce it by 2/3, and I add usually some chicken broth. Mine always comes out, I feel like it's got terrific depth of flavor, and the meat is really tender and everything.
There's one other trick we just tested today at Milk Street. You can use miso and water as a basic stock. A little red miso with water, and you can add spices, but just those things as a base for a stew or a braise is actually delicious.
And the meat will give off its own flavor.
And a white
anyway.
Miso and water for poultry.
Right.
But that's red miso is a wonderful flavor ingredient. And also, the sauce will be nice, deep, burnt orange color.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Make sure you're browning things well, too. And the tomato paste, I agree, really helps.
Okay, I will do that. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Thank you. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
My name is Alan, and I'm quite privileged to be speaking to you, Chris.
I don't know. That's a matter of opinion.
People probably should have an opinion, but it's a privilege to chat with you. How can we help you?
Well, I was actually quite thrilled to receive my first issue of Milk Street. And on the first page, I see Pie Crust Perfect, and that's the first article I went to. And I'm reading, and I see in bold letters, "Don't skip the sour cream." So my question basically is based on kosher laws. Whenever we have a meat meal, we are not permitted to eat dairy together with meat, or even after the meat meal, we would have to wait 6 hours before we could have anything dairy. So if I wanted to make a pie that I could eat after a meat meal, I would need to have a substitute for butter, which could probably be easy to find, but I'm not so sure that I could find a suitable non-dairy substitute for sour cream.
Well, in that recipe, we only used, I think, 2 tablespoons of sour cream. And you could, if you wanted, just eliminate that. 2 tablespoons of butter added instead of the sour cream, that would be fine. If you can't use butter, there are recipes using vegetable oil pie crusts. I don't love them because they come out like cookie dough.
Heavier, I think.
Yeah, they're kind of crispy. They're not flaky. They're not tender. But they do work.
I haven't tried any of the new vegetable shortenings that are, you know, different. Have you tried them, Chris?
Yeah, that's the other thing you could use. The new Crisco that doesn't have trans fats, and you can make a lovely pie dough with that.
Yeah, it's very flaky.
Very flaky. That recipe depended on cornstarch and water.
Which is so interesting.
And you cooked it into a gel and then froze it for 10 minutes so it was chilled.
Do you think that would make a difference if you added that and used Crisco?
If you did that with Crisco, I think it would be great.
I think that's the solution here.
Just substitute Crisco for butter.
Crisco for butter and extra Crisco for the amount of
sour cream.
Yeah, that should work
fine.
And do
the cornstarch thing.
It'll be fine. In fact, it may actually be flakier than butter.
It probably will.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, thank you very much for the suggestion.
Pleasure.
I will actually let you or your magazine know how it worked out.
Oh, that would be great.
Alan, thank you so much. What a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care. This is Milk Street Radio. If you have a cooking question, give us a ring anytime. 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or send us an email at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Nick Cholas from Chicago. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I need some advice from you guys because I'm having a party this weekend, and I happened on a 12-pound goose that I got for a real bargain, and I need your advice how to cook it.
I have a couple suggestions. There's a lot of fat under the skin. I've cooked a goose by simmering it in water for about 40 minutes, just a very slow simmer. Take it out, let it cool off, dry it, and then roast it. And you get rid of a lot of that extra fat. The other way I've done it is the old Fanny Farmer method from 1896, is where you take the breasts off and cook those, saute those essentially. You can saute them and then finish them in a low oven. And then the dark meat you roast. Because the dark meat and the breast meat are going to cook
it
different
times. Or you could confit the legs, because you'll have enough goose fat, maybe, you know, that gets rendered out, or you pull out all the little globs of goose fat, and then you can melt them down. Then you can. Have you ever made confit before?
I haven't actually, no.
Essentially what it is low and slow cooking in its own fat, which is absolutely delicious. And you throw in some garlic and thyme, and you just let it cook slowly in fat till it's tender. So you could do that with the legs as well.
You'd have to go out and buy some.
You probably have to buy some excess fat.
I think the simplest method is simmer for 40 minutes in water, take it out, and then finish it in an oven.
You know, Ariane Degan poaches it a lot longer than that. She even does it a day ahead. So she'll take it, put it breast side down, and she sautés up some vegetables, adds white wine, chicken broth, some water in a roasting pan on top of the stove. You need something large. And puts it in there about 2/3 submerged. And then covers it and cooks it, you know, breast side down for the, like, first hour, and then turns it over for another couple hours until it's tender when you prick it with a knife. And then takes it right out, dries it, and roasts it in a hot oven for about 30 minutes.
That's a good idea.
You could also do it a day ahead. Cool it, save the broth. All the fat will come to the top. You can reduce down the broth and make a nice sauce out of it.
Yeah, I like doing it a day ahead. That way it's all prepared ahead of time.
You know what I would do is go, because Chris seems to agree that it's really a good idea to poach to begin with to get rid of that excess fat. If you want, because Ariane Degan, who has D'Artagnan, are you aware of that website?
No, I'm not.
Okay. She sells goose and wild everything and this is how she cooks her goose. And when I, one time I did goose with Julia Child, and she also poached it first before she roasted
she
it.
She stole my idea, man. Whoops.
Whoops. Who came first?
Maybe.
The Julia or the Chris?
I guess the Julia.
I think the Julia.
Okay, well, now I'm going to steal her idea, too.
Okay, well, go on the D'Artagnan website, because it will give you all the details.
And drink a couple bottles of wine.
Yeah, and drink a couple bottles
of wine. All right, give the Julia Child method a shot.
Will do.
Yeah, slash Ariane slash Chris Kimball.
Right. Perfect. Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Thanks, Nick.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, my interview with Alon Shaya, chef and author of Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. That's right after the break. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are, and I think that makes it very food friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavors of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded like, oh wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just want to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Today, Elon Shaya is an award-winning chef in New Orleans, but his success wasn't always a given. Elon, how are you?
I'm great, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, when I pick up a cookbook, most of the time it's Happy Days Are Here Again, right? They're talking about their wonderful family or the great food. And your book certainly has a fair amount of that, but it also, it's called An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. And it is an odyssey. So let's start with your grandparents. One of your grandfathers was sent to the front lines from Romania during the Second World War. Could you just start there?
Yeah. When I set out to write the book, I kind of began asking all of these questions that I needed answers to about my family. So I learned a lot that my grandfather was a Christian and he married a Jewish woman, which was my grandmother. When World War II really started to take hold in Eastern Europe and the Germans were coming into Romania, my grandfather was, you know, they found out that he was married to a Jewish woman. And as punishment for that, he was sent to fight on the Russian border, you know, fight alongside the Germans. And so he went there and realized what a horrible situation that he was in and tried to escape, fled into the woods, and was shot and captured by Russian troops and then put into a prison of war camp and later died there of disease.
And then your grandfather on the other side lived in Sofia, right, in Bulgaria. And
yes,
narrowly escaped a similar fate, the camps, and then ended up in Jerusalem in the late 40s. So
yeah.
That, and then your father also had kind of a rough childhood as well, right?
Yeah. You know, you're talking about Eastern Europe and Jewish families during Hitler's reign, and it was not an easy life for any of them. My father escaped communist Romania for Israel, and then eventually left Israel to come to America. And he actually moved to America 2 years before my mother and my sister and I did, so that he could raise up enough money to fly us out.
So your dad leaves the family at some point, but you'd see him on fishing trips. And you describe, it's the little details that always are so telling, but you remember, among other things, the soggy sandwiches, because he'd have a cooler, right, with the ice.
Yeah.
By the time you get around to eat the sandwich, they were kind of soaked through, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So a year after my sister and mother and I moved to America, my parents divorced and my mother was then raising us on our own. My father, we would go on these fishing trips outside of Margate, and we would, he would put me in this little like 12-foot boat, and during those times kind of like tell all of the stories about, you know, why him and my mom weren't together again and kind of how hard of a life he had and how much he loved me, but how he had to really, you know, fight for every little thing. And so there were kind of these like miserable times for me where I would just have to sit there and listen. And, you know, eventually we would, like low tide would come and we'd be like stuck in mud. And so we'd be like sitting there for 3.5 hours, you know, with no water and just talking. And we would eat these turkey sandwiches that my dad made and would put in the Ziploc bags. But inevitably, like, right, the water would leak into them and they'd be like floating around in the ice in the cooler. And like nothing has ever stuck to the roof of your mouth more than a wet, soggy, white bread turkey sandwich with mayonnaise. And so like one of my vivid memories is just kind of like getting my finger like covered in like fish guts and like scraping this soggy turkey sandwich off the top of my mouth. But then we would catch all these small little fish and we would bring them back to the house. And I would watch my dad take them, clean them, dust them in a little bit of flour and pan fry them in butter and just get them all golden brown. And then we would pick the meat off of the bones with our hands and kind of dip it in that brown butter with chopped parsley and lemon. And I just remember being so impressed by my dad at that moment, like by the way he would cook those fish. So every time I would sign up to go on one of these fishing trips, you know, I knew the end result, and it was going to be these beautifully fried fish that I would be able to eat. And that was worth it to me.
So you start out, let's talk about you now. So you start out in one of your jobs. I think, I love this story. They sent you across the street to a Rite Aid or something.
Yeah. So one of my first jobs was at this kosher butcher shop. And I told them I was 16 years old, but I was 13 years old. And I needed money to buy cigarettes and cheesesteaks when I got out of school. So I started working there on the weekends, and I would be sweeping the aisles and stocking shelves. And you know, they could tell that I really loved food and I was really passionate about it. But they would send me on all these kind of like impossible missions that I would later learn they were just messing with me. But at one point, I had to walk down the street to the Rite Aid and ask the woman behind the register, who also happened to be my next-door neighbor and one of my mom's friends, for 10 feet of fallopian tube. And this is like, you know, pre-seventh grade for me, right? Like I hadn't taken health ed yet. So I didn't know what the fallopian tube was. I just knew that I was going to go to Rite Aid and pick up several feet of it. And it was many embarrassing moments like that. You know, I knew that I would be set up at times, but I would do it anyway just so that I could like continue to get the attention from them.
Yeah.
So that they would let me do more stuff with food.
You end up in New Orleans at Harrah's making mac and cheese for 5,000 people, as you said. But you were also in charge of the chocolate fountain at the dessert bar.
Yeah.
And I guess you said a lot of sort of detritus, a lot of garbage ended up in that fountain. You had to constantly clean it out.
Yeah. I was the chef of the buffet at Harrah's when I first moved to New Orleans. And the buffet would serve about 5,000 people on a busy day. It's a big operation. And I'm 23 years old. I'm like here in New Orleans, ready to learn about Cajun and Creole food. And the only job I could get was at Harrah's buffet.
Well, you also had an experience after Katrina there. You cooked for people at a hospital, for example. You cooked massive amounts of red beans and rice and showed up at the hospital just to feed people, and you did that day after day.
Yeah. You know, Katrina really changed my life, and it reminded me of what people want from food. And here I am in the parking lot of this looted-out Walmart with a big pot of really bad red beans and rice because there was no produce or meat or smoked sausage to put in there. Everything was completely rotten. And I would make these like vegetarian red beans and rice, and I'd serve them to first responders and people that were hungry. And it made such a huge impression on them because they were able to get a hot meal. And it reminded me of why I cooked in the first place from a young age, because it was usually the only trick up my sleeve. Like, food was the way that I brought joy to people, and that I got positive reactions from people even throughout my kind of hellish childhood as a teenager. When I would cook, I would get a seat at the table. And here I was post-Katrina feeling that exact same emotion. And it really inspired me to then move to Italy to learn how to cook from Italian grandmothers, because that's what was kind of speaking to me at the time.
You also talked about Vincenzo, right? And you got a job in his pizzeria, I believe. And you thought the first day you'd be walking and making pizzas, right?
Yeah, I thought I would walk into this
or not
pizzeria in Parma, and Enzo the pizzaiolo would, you know, he did take me under his wing, but he taught in a very militaristic style, and you had to really get through every level before you could get to the next one. So, you know, like mushrooms was 4 days, you know, like I 4 days I was only allowed to cut mushrooms, and then I graduated to cheese, and then eventually I was able to like touch the flour and make the dough with him, and then eventually I was able to actually make pizzas there.
Okay, let's get to cooking now. So you starred Broth Recipe in A Pot Full of Ice.
Yes. This is something that I learned in Italy about how to make a really good clear broth. What I learned was that you can take, say it's duck bones, and you have a big pot full of duck bones, and you add a bunch of ice and a little bit of water to it, and you let it sit overnight just out at room temperature, and the ice will keep it cold, but eventually it will melt throughout the night, and all of the blood will leach out of the carcasses. Then when you turn the heat on, the blood has all of these proteins that kind of soak up all the impurities in the water and bring it up to the top and kind of create their own raft. So I'm sure you've seen when you make broth, like you skim that foam that rises to
the
top.
Or you use egg whites to trap it. Yeah.
Right. Well, the foam is usually because of the blood. So the more blood you have in there in the water, the more foam comes up and the more impurities are absorbed, and you get an extremely clear broth. And that's the method that I learned to make brodo and terza, which means broth in thirds. And it's what they serve the Anellini and brodo in Parma.
I always wondered why that tasted so good.
Yes.
Now let's switch over to the opposite side. You sous vide turkey.
Yeah, it's true. I do sous vide my turkey breast.
So defend yourself.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready. I think that turkey breast especially dries out and gets that kind of squeaky texture very easily. And sous vide-ing it sounds really fancy. It's really not that fancy. It's just cooking something very slowly and very evenly. And I find that I can do that with a turkey breast and leave the skin on and cook it to a specific temperature very slowly, whereas the proteins are never being forced to denature at a rapid pace like it would be if you were flashing it in a 500-degree oven. And so the juices really stay in the meat. And when then, after you pull it out of the bag, you can then put it in a broiler and get the skin really beautiful and crispy and have the meat just perfectly cooked.
So you, I believe, went back to Israel to cook with your grandmother her recipes. Is that correct at some time?
Yeah. When I had just moved to New Orleans in 2003, I had a chance to go back to Israel to see my grandmother for the last time because she knew she didn't have much time left. And I saw this as an opportunity to really kind of reconnect with her about the foods that she would cook for me when I was a kid and that we would cook together. And she had already thought about that and already had a plan in her head that she was going to teach me every single recipe that she knew how to make during this trip. And so I would see her in the morning, and she would give me a list of things to go to the market and buy. And I would walk to the markets in Jaffa and, you know, pick up the meats and the produce and the cheeses. And I would come back and I would begin cooking all of these things. And she would give me direction. And I would take teaspoons of something and bring them back into the bedroom where she was. And she'd taste it and tell me what I needed to adjust. And I really documented every last bit of this experience in a notebook as I was doing it. And when I opened Shaya in New Orleans, that journal of recipes that I got from my grandmother really served as the opening menu, part of it. And it was just really special when my mother came to eat there for the first time. You know, she tasted the lutenitsa, which is this puree of roasted peppers and eggplants and tomato. And my mom just started to cry, and she was like, "Your Safta would have been really proud to have seen this happen."
Alon, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure. And hope to have you back on Milk Street sometime soon.
Thank you, Chris.
That was chef and author Alon Shaya. His new book is entitled Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel. Now it's time to chat with Catherine Smart about this week's recipe, oven-poached salmon. Catherine, how are you?
I'm great, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I used to get lessons from a French cooking teacher back in the early 70s, and one of the lessons I learned was how to poach fish. Now, in those days, I had the big metal fish poacher with a tray that comes out. You make a court bouillon, which was a flavored fish broth. It was a big deal. And I also thought that poaching fish, a lot of the flavor in the fish leached out into the court bouillon anyway. It wasn't a great method. So I asked you not too long ago to come up with a better way for quote-unquote poaching fish. So what are we going
to
do?
So, Chris, we are going to take poaching to the oven. And rather than digging around for our old fish poacher, we're simply going to marinate a whole side of salmon in a little soy sauce. Then we use a foil sling and a rimmed baking sheet, and we toss it in the oven. Now, one of the tricks here is instead of simmering it in like a court bouillon where the flavor might leach out, we just douse it in vermouth. So that really amps up the flavor. And when we cover the whole pan with foil, that creates steam so it can quote unquote poach in the oven.
So it's oven steamed salmon. I mean, to be technical.
Technically, yes, but we're referring to it as oven poached. And just like a traditional poached salmon, you'd serve it with a sauce made from that cooking liquid. So we take a little bit of that vermouth salmon juice, delicious cooking liquid. We add some dill, we add some butter, and then serve it with lemon wedges. And I have to say, Chris, despite how easy it is, it's pretty impressive when you serve your guests the whole side of salmon.
You eat with your eyes. Catherine, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. You can find this recipe and all of our recipes at 177milkstreet.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Dan Pashman and I discuss the food of The Simpsons. We'll be right back. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips at 177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now, Sarah Moulton and I will be answering a few more of your culinary questions. Hi, Sarah. You ready for a new batch of questions?
Yes, Chris. I am very ready. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Brendan.
Hi, Brendan. Where are you calling from?
Fresno, California.
How can we help you today?
Well, I have a question about making a strawberry cake you might be familiar with. I've made it multiple times, and the first few times that I've made it, it was delicious, but the cake texture came out really dense. And I was actually out of town at my mom's house, and I was making it again, and she only had a stand mixer that had, instead of a paddle attachment, all it had was whisk attachment. And when I used that attachment, I don't know if it was that or what happened, but the cake came out perfect. It was really nice and light and fluffy. So I'm just wondering, could that have done something different, or was there something else going on maybe that made it light and fluffy?
What's the recipe? Are you beating whole eggs with sugar to start, or what are you doing?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the answer right
there. That's the answer. What did you used to use before you used a whisk? Just a spoon?
A paddle attachment.
A paddle attachment, yeah. No, it's absolutely the whisk.
Right. The whisk will incorporate more air, and this cake depends in part on incorporating air into the whole eggs and the sugar to get a nice light texture to them. The paddle is good for batters that don't really depend on incorporating a lot of air.
Right. I mean, especially when you have a high percentage of eggs, that's sort of part of their role there is to add leavening, you know, they just naturally without a leavener. I imagine there's a leavener in the recipe too.
Yeah, baking powder.
Yeah.
You ended up using the right tool for the job.
Right. The recipe called for a paddle? That's silly.
Yeah, the recipe calls for a paddle, you know, and that, I don't know. You know, one other thing I was thinking was, because it says to microwave the strawberries and then strain them and then reduce them into a syrup and down to, I think, a quarter cup or whatever. And I was wondering, maybe in the past, if I didn't reduce the liquid enough and it was too much liquid, could that have something to do with it? Or no, is it just the...
No, but you said the difference was between using a paddle and using a whisk in the beater, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
that's it.
Were all other things the same?
Yeah, well, that, like I was saying, the only other thing that it could have been was maybe the moisture content of that strawberry syrup was lower.
No.
Would that make a difference?
Not really.
I don't think it'd make that much of a difference.
I mean, if you had a cup of liquid versus a quarter, that might make a difference.
Yes.
But it sounds like you're talking about a tablespoon or two, right? Difference.
Yeah, a couple tablespoons.
No,
that
wouldn't matter.
It's the whisk.
It's the whisk.
The question is, do you have a stand mixer with a whisk attachment?
Oh, yeah, I definitely do.
Oh, good. Well,
I'll be using the whisk from now on.
You should be. Yay.
That was easy.
That was much simpler than other things.
That was an easy one.
Yeah. Thanks,
all right,
Brendan.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm glad you could help me.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. If you have a cooking question, just give us a ring, 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Holly Stark.
Hi, Holly Stark. Where are you from?
Newark, Ohio.
And how can we help you?
This is such an honor. I watch you both, you and Sarah, all the time.
Well, thank you.
So here's my question. How do I know what to brown first? The protein, whatever it might be, or the aromatics? I see each done first for different recipes, but I don't understand why. So that when I am cooking my own food without a recipe, I would like to know the difference. When do you brown the aromatics first, and when do you brown the protein first?
This is a classic French question.
No, you should let me go first.
So I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah, because I know what you're going to say.
Well, I know what you're going to say, too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, there you go. I always brown the protein first, because then when you take it out, you get all those brown bits in the bottom, and vegetables tend to have quite a lot of liquid. So they sort of start deglazing the pan a bit. And sometimes I'll even put the lid on after I add the vegetables to get that steam going to scrape up the brown bits. And then after the steam evaporates, they'll brown. So I start with the protein and then go with the vegetables. Now, Chris?
Well, no. Up until Milk Street, I would...
Up until he gave up all, you know, French culture.
Yes.
I've thrown out 500 years of Northern European cooking.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. I would do the same. I would say a lot of recipes, however, you don't need to brown the meat. The reason is you're adding more umami flavor to a dish. And the way I cook these days, I don't really want more umami. I want a lot of other flavors as well. For example, if you do a stew, you can leave the top off and let the heat of the oven brown the meat if there's not too much liquid in it.
I saw that show.
Yeah, and so there's a famous Tuscan beef dish that does that. So, or I use less meat because meat's more of a flavoring for me than it is the main course. So yes, meat first, sofrito, the onions, et cetera, second. But in many cases,
don't bother browning.
You don't actually need to brown the meat.
I don't agree with that, but that's okay.
So I agree with that totally. With any kind of a stew, I get that. But let's say you're doing a ground protein. It could be hamburger, turkey, lamb. Do you generally brown it first as well and then the aromatics? Because it seems to me it's easy if you brown it and you take it out and then you're going to braise it. You know, and the only example I can think of...
Like bolognese?
...is ground protein. It's like you don't take that out after you brown it, generally.
No, well, if you take a bolognese, for example, you don't really want to brown it directly in the pan because it's going to get hard and
nasty.
It is.
It's because you've got little teeny weeny pieces of meat. Right. I agree with that. You don't want to brown ground meat because then you've dried it out. So you just want to get it.
Well, I do that wrong. Okay.
You want to get it till it's lost its color. It's lost its pinkness. So in that case, yeah, I might start with some onions and get them softened and then add the ground meat. And then by the time it's turned, it's lost its pinkness, the onions will have cooked a little more.
Yeah, the ground meat, you're not trying to brown it to create a Maillard reaction, which are those fond at the bottom of the pan, because then it would be cooked to over 200 degrees and it would be tough.
Right.
Yeah. I know all these terms because I watch you both religiously. So thank you for, I've just learned so much watching your shows.
Well, good. Thank you for calling. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Holly, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Here is this week's Milk Street Basic. It's no secret that here at Milk Street, we're big fans of tahini, the Middle Eastern sesame paste. It adds a lot of body to all sorts of dishes, sweet and savory. Here are a few new ways to use tahini at home. First, spread it on cauliflower or broccoli, season with salt and pepper, and then roast the vegetables in a very hot oven, 475, until well browned, about half an hour. Toss the roasted cauliflower or broccoli with a handful of chopped cilantro or parsley and chopped cashews. Or you can make a flavored butter to smear on roast fish or chicken. Blend 2 tablespoons tahini with 2 tablespoons of softened salted butter. Then mix in some fresh herbs and a teaspoon of lemon zest. Third, swap out peanut butter in your next peanut butter and jam sandwich and use tahini instead. It's really good with multigrain breads and with raspberry or apricot jam. Finally, use tahini on your oatmeal. A drizzle adds richness, also pairs well with maple syrup or brown sugar. For more culinary inspiration, please go to 177milkstreet.com. Now it's time for Dan Pashman, who always has a very curious view of the world of cooking. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. I was recently watching one of my all-time favorite TV shows, The Simpsons. Are you a Simpsons fan?
It's one of my favorite shows.
Do you have an all-time favorite food-related episode or moment from The Simpsons?
Yes. There was sort of an alternate reality show of some kind, and one of them was Raining Donuts. Do you remember that?
Yes, See, Chris, you know, every once in a while, like, I get that the conceit of our conversations here is that we're sort of an odd couple, but actually, we're, you know, sometimes we're really two peas in a pod.
And he was going through rejecting all these possible universes.
Yes,
and
yes,
he rejected the Raining Donuts without thinking about it.
That is my all-time favorite Simpsons joke. It's from a Halloween episode, and Homer's trying to fix a toaster, and he keeps getting electrocuted and sent to the past. The third time he gets sent back to the present after doing something in the dinosaur age, He comes back to the present. He comes upstairs to his living room. He lives in a mansion. The kids are all sitting nicely at the table. There's a beautiful dinner set. Marge is dressed very nicely, and the kids say, good afternoon, Father. Will we be taking the new Lexus to Aunt Patty and Aunt Selma's funeral? And Homer says, nice house, well-behaved kids, luxury car, dead sisters-in-law. I've hit the jackpot. And he sits down at dinner and says, Marge, would you please pass me a donut? And she says, what are donuts?
Yeah, what is a donut? Right.
And Homer flips out, starts screaming, runs screaming from the room back to the basement. And after he's left, Marge looks outside and says, oh, look, it's raining. And donuts are falling from the sky. There's so many great Simpsons food jokes. Food is such a recurring theme, of course, with the character of Homer. But also, there's a great episode where Marge and Bart and Lisa become food bloggers, and it sort of lampoons fancy food bloggers and pretentiousness in food. So The Simpsons, food, a hallmark part of the show. I had the extraordinary opportunity to go to LA and hang out in the Simpsons writer's room.
Really?
Yes, to learn more about the role of food on the show and also behind the scenes.
So tell me.
Well, so TV writers are notoriously food-obsessed people. But one of the most interesting things, I had the opportunity to chat with Matt Groening, who's the creator of The Simpsons, and he told me that the advances in animation technology have changed the types of food jokes that they can make on The Simpsons.
Now, I don't understand that. How does that work?
So in the very early days of the show, it was almost a running joke that when the family was sitting down at the table, they were eating slop, because that was really like that was the most detailed thing they could animate.
Oh, I see.
Then they got to the point with animation that they could do like a ribeye, and you could animate that. Now, with digital technology, they can animate the tiniest differences in rolls of sushi.
Right.
They can even have a menu with very small lettering that may only show on the screen for a split second, but it's the kind of thing that fans will pause and then take a screen capture of and share on social media and obsess over all the little jokes that are hidden in that menu that was only on the screen for a split second. So it has opened up all these new venues for food jokes.
So instead of worrying about the basic plot and character development, they're now going down the rabbit hole of insane behind-the-scenes jokes in the menus on the show?
Right, right. Well, yeah. I wouldn't say instead, but I would say in addition to. So it's almost as if like there are now more different layers of jokes on The Simpsons and food jokes in particular because of advances in animation technology. Now they can nest a joke within a joke within a joke.
So where does this lead us to? A show within a show within a show?
Yeah. And I think that we can even see a future when animation could become so detailed that you will have to almost watch parts of an episode either in slow motion or freeze frames and then go on social media and look at all the screen grabs of the tiniest details of things that you hadn't noticed when the show aired, but that they can now add in all these teeny tiny jokes, especially with regard to food that you might not have noticed before.
And then 10 years from now, everyone's going to say, let's go back to the era when they ate slop because the show was better.
Right. Exactly.
Dan Pashman behind the scenes at The Simpsons. I think we should watch that show more closely for the inside jokes.
Let it rain donuts, Chris.
Now that's a slogan I can get behind. That was Dan Pashman of The Sporkful. You know, Dan Pashman and I both chose the same Simpsons episode as our all-time favorite, the one about donuts raining from the sky. But the Simpsons plots often revolved around food, from the Krusty Burger Rib Witch to the Flaming Moe Cocktail to the time Homer thinks he has fugu poisoning. In that episode, thinking he's about to die, he vows to live life to the fullest. But he soon returns to watching bowling and eating pork rinds. Well, there is a lot of Homer Simpson in all of us. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in late, you can find Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, or Radio Public. Please remember to subscribe to the show. That way you'll get every single episode downloaded to your phone each week. If you want to learn more about Milk Street, please go to 177milkstreet.com. There you can download each week's recipe, watch the new season of our TV show, subscribe to our magazine, or order our new book, Milk Street Tuesday Nights. We're also on Instagram and Twitter at 177milkstreet. And on Facebook, we're Christopher Kimball's Milk Street. We'll be back next week, and thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer, Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor, Melissa Allison. Producer, Annie Sinzaba. Associate producer, Jackie Nowak, and production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer, Douglas Sugarts. Additional editing from Vicky Merrick and Sydney Lewis, and audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Tubop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.